Okay.
EMS 8730.
Hello, caller?
Relax, relax. We're trying to help you here.
This is not a job for everybody.
Losing fib now.
This is not a job to get rich or stuff like that.
Calm down. Everything's going to be okay.
We're the doctors of the street. That's what we are.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp. EMS Office Hours is a live, weekly EMS podcast for all EMS professionals.
Discussing a variety of EMS topics and bringing your EMS concerns to light. So turn down that scanner and turn up your speakers.
And join us to find out what's really on the minds of EMS.
When it comes to response times, you know, a lot of, I guess sometimes you've got that perception of that 8 minute window, 8 to 10 minute window for, you know, for response. And that seems to be what a lot of EMS systems kind of shoot for. But isn't that really more for like cardiac arrest patients, not really for every patient?
Well, I think that's...
Go ahead.
Okay, this is Tom, and I was going to say, I think that's an individual thing for each community to determine. I know that Hilton Head Island and Rescue shoots for 5 minutes or less, I think 80% of the time, and the way they measure it is wheels up to wheels down at the curbside of the emergency. So I think anytime we talk about response times, we have to be very careful that we define the time segment we're referring to.
What about like, do you guys have like where you are, Tom? Is there a set like a different call type that have responded to lights and sirens and some that aren't, or is it everything lights and sirens regardless of how it is dispatched?
Well, we get no prompt from dispatch that tells us how to respond. I think it's understood that we respond lights and sirens. However, it is up to the discretion of the company officer to decide. Or the company officer, or let's say the lead paramedic, in the event that there's not a company officer, we do have the discretion to respond what we call code one. And I would say that would be in those situations where it's a fall with injury possible assistance call, the patient's requesting no lights and sirens, something like that, to where we would have the discretion to just respond without the lights and sirens.
Hey, Tom. Tom,
yeah.
This is Josh from Wantanu, Josh Knapp. And, you know, I have a question. Does, in your system, when it's dispatched, you don't get a emergency priority number with it? You know, like in New York, we have a 1 through 9 system in terms of priority, code 1 obviously being the highest. But there's nothing there to tell the receiving crew the sort of the degree of urgency of the call other than the call type?
No, there's not. And I think we do use a emergency medical dispatch program, and the dispatchers do pull cards, but in my jurisdiction, they're going to get, unless it's an unconscious patient or a confirmed cardiac arrest, they're going to get the same response regardless of what type of emergency it is. In other words, the dispatcher isn't choosing between a basic ambulance, an advanced life support ambulance. They're not deciding whether or not to dispatch a fire engine along with the ambulance. And so I'm not saying our system is perfect. I know that there are other systems that send a lot more manpower on the first alarm, say to Delta and Echo level calls. I'm not sure how that correlates to the priority system that you use. But for example, in my mind, a cardiac patient that is having chest discomfort and shortness of breath should probably get more than one EMT and one paramedic on a single ambulance on the first alarm. That's my opinion. You know, they won't in my system unless the first unit requests backup. And so I think there's some room for improvement, but no, it's not as if they tone it out as a particular code or level.
Wow, this is the first time I think I feel spoiled as a New York medic. You know, we have a tiered response, and depending on the urgency, the call type, whether it's a 1, 2, or 3, will determine whether or not we get additional resources right out of the gate. And a lot of times, and obviously the problem with our dispatching system, and this is nationwide from what I understand, is that, you know, we have somebody who's really not a deep medical person asking card questions to a caller and then dispatching based on the answers to those questions. So a lot of times we call the first response engines that show up on the scene and somehow get there a lot of times before us, the big red markers, the big red job markers, because a lot of times that's all they're needed for. But it's sort of interesting to have it come back and just say, well, we go out on our own there, and if we need more response, and you have a much longer, I mean, if you needed somebody, how long would it be before they got there?
Well, that's variable, and it depends on the situation. Usually what happens, and I'll tell you, the flip side is we save a lot of time on the call processing side. So if everyone's in the station and we have a patient that is out on the beach and has had a syncopal episode, and they determine, say, that my fire station, which is fire station number 3, is closest to the emergency, and they send medic 3 on the call, after they dispatch our unit, I think they finish the call processing, and by that time they might find out that the patient's complaining of chest discomfort or is having a grand mal seizure or something like that. At that point in time, I would request the second unit before I actually arrive on scene, just for the logistics of getting them up off the beach isn't always simple. And I should also mention that if the first due unit is unavailable and there's an engine in the area, the closest unit will be dispatched regardless of call type. So if the first due medic is gone in that district but there's an engine there, it'll be the next closest ambulance, but the closest engine will automatically respond regardless of call type. But if the first due ambulance is not on another call, then it will typically be dispatched by itself unless the patient's unconscious or they request help.
Right, right. So does this response time, does the going lights and sirens part, is that making a difference in your response?
I think it makes a minimal difference. On Hilton Head Island, we have Opticon, so we have traffic light preemption,
which I think
probably does more to assist our response times than the lights and sirens. And we're very fortunate in that Hilton Head Island covers about a 60-square-mile area, about 46 square miles of which is land. And we have 7 fire stations. And so the majority of the areas we can reach travel distance in 5 minutes, not all areas, but in the majority of areas we can reach in 5 minutes or less, if assuming that no one else is already out on a call. And so I would say it confers a marginal benefit during high traffic times because we are a high tourist area.
Let me ask you something about the device that you use. What's the name of it again to change the lights?
Because it's called
Opticon. Okay, Opticon. When you have
Opticon,
that and your drivers are using that, you're approaching a light, you flipped on the switch, the light's changed in your direction. Do you have protocols on how you pass through that intersection?
Our current protocol is that if we have a green light, that we slow down and exercise due regard. If we have a red light, for whatever reason, our protocol is that we come to a complete stop. I'm not saying that always happens.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. We just had a officers' meeting, our monthly officers' meeting, and there was the fire chief showed up on the board in front of everybody about 10 YouTube videos of our fire department. There's some kid on Hilton Head Island that videotapes us going through intersections, not because he's trying to catch us doing anything wrong. I think he's just a fire buff.
Right.
But he takes video of us all the time, and so he had several different examples, and it showed the good, the bad, and the ugly. It showed what to do and what not to do. And as a as a fire captain, as a company officer, and as someone that's very serious about crew safety, and frankly, the safety of the public we serve, I don't have a lot of tolerance for unsafe drivers. And so I don't like to see 30, 40,000-pound fire trucks flying through red lights without slowing down. That's dangerous. And so, you know, in my mind, it's just an added layer of accountability, and I'm okay with that. But so anyway, yes, we do have policies on the books. The degree to which they're followed all the time, I don't know.
Well, I don't think that you're alone in that degree to be followed. You know, I grew up in EMS in sort of a rough part of Manhattan here, and the guys that were showing me the ropes on the bus were generally yahoos, and they would fly down the street and not at all coming close to anything that I would call due regard, more like, you know, hell-bent on destruction. And, you know, I think we just got lucky majority of times, and I got real lucky because I wasn't on the bus on the few times that they didn't get lucky. But, you know, because before this show, and, you know, one of the things Jim nags me about is to sort of read up on the subject. I don't know why, Jim, you want me to have any additional knowledge on the subject we talk about. I think I should be like everybody else, but that's okay. And within the New York State Bureau of EMS, we have a policy statement, and the policy statement specifically outlines several times that, you know, the operator is supposed to be operating with due regard. Coming to a red light, you're supposed to stop. You know, yielding traffic is only a courtesy. At no times are emergency vehicles authorized to do any of some of the dangerous things. It's just it's more of a courtesy to them under specific circumstances where they need to. And at all times, the operation of an emergency mode is in the control of the crew. So even though the vehicle is dispatched, and this is one of those vague things because I know that I've seen crews get in trouble for not responding in an quote-unquote appropriate fashion. But at the same time, you know, if conditions don't permit it, you gotta do what you think is right. You know, this is one of those, I sort of hear Tim in the back of my head saying, you know, damn the establishment, you know, you have to use your own judgment and do what is right on, you know, the operation. And this is one of those things. It's just too damn dangerous when you go lights and sirens.
So you're saying you have crews respond without using lights and sirens because they think lights and sirens is not safe?
No, not at all. No, that's the opposite of I'm saying that in times when there is well, like what Jim was going to at the end of the program, and so I'm sort of jumping it, in terms of, you know, everybody's shouting at you, get going, get going. Let's say you pick up a MOS, and you know what? They don't need lights and sirens all the way. They don't need a full escort. And if you've ever picked up highway, and I don't know how they respond in your area, Tim, but, you know, we pick up PD, and they're always ready for an escort, even if the guy has a hangnail. And, you know, it's like I've had to, you know, more than once in those scenarios just say, guys, this is not an emergent situation. We don't need to endanger everybody's life getting this guy in. He's stable. He's fine. He needs to go to the hospital. We'll get him there, but we don't need to go lights and sirens. And, you know, it's a fallacy in terms of when there's a patient on board, you need to use lights and sirens or you need to use lights. I mean, it's really up to the treating crew what mode of operation you go in when you have a patient. When you get a call type and it's a priority one, priority two, you know, whatever it is along that line, you of course have to respond in a lights and sirens manner. But that doesn't take away what Tom was saying in terms of that due regard, and we're sort of defining what is due regard. And one of the basic tenets, I think, is when you come to a red light, you stop. You look both ways. You see if the traffic is clear, and then you proceed through the red light with caution. You don't barrel ass through the red light. I mean, this is a particular bug up my butt, Tim, in terms of ambulance safety, because I've seen too many guys and girls, you know, operate like they are Mario Andretti and have full license to drive anywhere. I know a guy who used to regularly drive up on the sidewalks. You know, I mean, that's
the type one of the problems with. I think that one of the problems with safety is that we require people to come to a full stop at a red light rather than use their judgment going through the light at whatever speed is safe. We don't allow people to use their judgment, so people never learn how to judge what is appropriate and what is safe. Coming to a full stop is not safe.
You're coming to a full stop at a red light is not safe.
Right. You still have to get going at some point, so what's the difference between coming to a full stop and going through at a walking speed? You get people to stop for you. Once you come to a full stop, traffic starts moving again.
Oh, absolutely not. You have your lights and sirens on, and you come to a full stop, you wait for the other traffic to stop. And then you.
I've driven in New York, and they start driving again.
Well, I think that part of that is the other driver's perception as well. You know, I understand when you come to complete stop, you can wind up giving the other driver that impression that okay, I'm stopped now, and I've arrived where I'm going to. But at the same time, I know what Josh is saying. You know, their job and what they're supposed to be doing is yielding to, you know, the emergency vehicle. Whether you're going through the red light at, you know, 30-40 miles an hour as opposed to, you know, a crawl.
Well, nobody's recommending that, and that's just one of the excuses people come up with for why they think that coming to a full stop is a good idea. They assume that the only alternative is blasting through a red light at full speed, which is something that does happen. There are people out there who do that, and they should be stopped from driving. But that's not using judgment.
Well, if you're talking about, and you're talking about, 10,000 pounds roughly worth of vehicle, that you need to be able to
stop at whatever point.
Instantaneously
if you
stop.
Can't
so
stop
if
it.
You're talking about rolling forward, and generally what I'm talking about is when I talk about a full stop, I don't mean a full stop and you sit there for 10 seconds and you wait. I'm talking about a stop where you, at one point, the inertia in your wheels is zero, and then you continue on. And there's nothing wrong with that type of mode, and you don't have to hit and I agree 100%, you don't have to hit the gas. But, you know, you come to a full stop so you can gather information on what's going on in that intersection, and then you can continue to go on. It's a momentary.
That's
it's
one
a
of the
momentary
problems with. That's one of the problems with the way people drive. They wait until they get to the place where they have to make a decision to start thinking about the decision they're going to make. They haven't been paying attention to what's been going on beforehand, so it's
well,
a sudden surprise.
Right.
You see people pull up and stop at yields.
You've said you've driven in New York. You know that you're basically driving down, a maze of corridors where you can't see the intersection except for maybe a few inches to the right and to the left. If you're lucky, if there isn't a truck parked loading and unloading on both sides of that intersection. Or in the case of Second Avenue, a truck parked and then a whole bunch of construction going on at the same time, so traffic is being squeezed, narrowed, and manipulated. I mean, really, truly, in order to get through safely, I absolutely agree. Some people don't start thinking until they make an action. But your action, once you flip on those lights and put your foot on the pedal, that action, you have to continue thinking all the way through. I mean, you're always responsible for the safety of yourself, but you're also responsible for the safety of your crew and the safety of the public when operating a vehicle, and that includes even the stupid people. I mean, I was going through an intersection last week, and we literally, I was with this guy with this different partner than we had, and we were literally just like gassed because we had a utility van come see our lights. The car in front of them stopped. They hit the gas, swerved around so hard they went on two wheels, swerved around the car, cut between us and this other car to get, in front of us. Had we been going a mile faster, we would have gotten T-boned.
I think I saw that in a video game.
Yeah, holy shit. It's like Frogger exemplified. I mean, this is one of those times.
At the same time, the heavy traffic like that isn't unique to just, New York City. I mean, a lot of areas, even major towns of small areas wind up having heavy traffic at intersections too. So I think it's a matter of deciding whether or not even putting the lights on to begin with for certain calls is even worth it. Why even endanger it?
Let's go back to the point Josh and I were talking about before he went into his diatribe. Does coming to a full stop do anything to improve safety? Absolutely not. If you're crawling through the intersection at a slow rate of speed, you can stop on a dime, and you can see more as you're going along. If you have to come to a full stop because visibility is impaired, you're going to have to pull forward at some point. And once you start doing that, you're moving just as if you hadn't come to a full stop. We need to teach people to use judgment in going through intersections. Coming to a full stop is a substitute for teaching judgment. This encourages people to make bad decisions. This is dangerous.
Tim, I'll tell you something. You're wrong here. And I don't want to get into a battle with you online, but that's not true. It's not a substitute for judgment. It's a way of operation. It's been proven over and over. I worked Look up Nadine Levick. Okay, she worked for the...
I know who she is.
Look up the paperwork. Okay, have you ever worked with her? I actually got a chance to work with her.
No.
All right, she is the
Has she compared using judgment with coming to a full stop?
Well, using judgment is a subjective thing. I mean, come on.
That's the nice thing about coming to a full stop. It allows people to say, we're preventing people from thinking, therefore we won't have people making mistakes by thinking the wrong thing. It is eliminating judgment, which is dangerous.
Tim, I'm going to jump in here for a second and call you out because you could say the same thing about an evidence-based checklist or a pre-flight checklist on an airplane. You say, okay, well, the pilot's not going to go down the checklist because that's taken away his judgment as a pilot. But
on the other hand, you can show evidence that those checklists work. You can't show evidence that using judgment going through an intersection is any more dangerous than coming to a full stop.
Oh, I think you
well,
can show...
You mean it's not been studied? I mean, to quote a fan of yours named Carl Sagan, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And if you have a sample size in my organization, let's say there's 100, I don't know the exact number, it's over 100, but let's say there's 100 firefighters, and every single one of them is required to have at least a Class E license in the state of South Carolina, and any one of them could be driving the ambulance on any given day. That's the variability of that sample size is 100%. Everybody drives a different way. And so
don't train them a certain way?
Oh, I train
you
them.
You don't say, this is what is good driving practice. I work with some people who are horrible drivers, and that is one of the few criticisms I have of my employers. They don't do enough to get rid of the bad drivers.
Tim, we have so much drivers training, it's unbelievable because we have ISO requirements and different things. We've all had SIBO, EBDT, we have regular quarterly drivers training, and if you pump a fire truck, then you get even more than that. My point is, human beings aren't robots. They have different vision. They have different senses. They have different decision-making capability. And my point is, if you take human beings and you take a large number of them, then even if you give them guidelines, there's variability in the implementation of the guidelines. And if I know firemen well enough, if you say, you guys just go out there and use your judgment, but you're not required to stop at the red light, you will have everything from people that stop at the red light because they think that's the safest way to do it to guys that just blow through the intersection and say, it was clear, Chief. I saw
it. Put a camera on the truck, and if somebody goes through it faster than 10 miles an hour, write them up. You have ways of double-checking on this. Let me finish. You've been talking a lot. You have ways of double-checking on what people are doing. It doesn't cost a lot to put a camera on a truck. You can do this to see how safely people are passing through intersections. You can come up with guidelines. This will be a maximum speed. You can look at what the intersection looks like and say, this is an intersection where clearly there is nobody around, while this one, you can barely see anything. Passing through there at 5 miles an hour is too fast.
Well, I guess I could, Tim, but I think the way that our organization functions is it's very complex because we have paramedics, we have firefighters, we have EMTs, we have driver operators, we have a hazmat team, we have a USAR team. We have so many different things that need to be checked for quality that you have to pick and choose what you're going to check for quality and monitor what you're going to invest your time and effort into. And I'm not saying that I'm a big fan of all blanket, lowest common denominator policies, but I think from a risk management standpoint, if I were a fire chief and knowing how devastating it would be to our fire department and, frankly, our community, if a fire engine rammed into a minivan with three children and killed them, it's just not tenable to me. And it's just so they can blow through a red light. And you know,
we're not talking about blowing through a red light.
I understand you're trying to compare coming to a complete stop with creeping. But that's an arbitrary.
Going through at a rate that is appropriate for what you can see, what the traffic conditions are, what the visibility conditions are for that intersection, and teaching people to use judgment in all other aspects of their driving. I work with people who will come to a full stop when they've got the lights and sirens going, but they have no problem throwing it in reverse and turning around and going almost the same speed backwards because they just don't understand. There's no set rule to tell them what to think, so they don't know how to think about how to drive.
Well, I guess, again, we're fortunate in that we have the Opticon system. So oftentimes, we're not faced. It doesn't work all the time. I'm not saying we never have red lights, because we do. But a lot of times, the light is green. And I will tell you that in practice, in reality, people are creeping through. They're not coming to a complete stop. But it is on the books to come to a complete stop, and I don't blame the fire chief for that.
The Opticom can also be a problem since it doesn't always work as quickly or predictably as it's supposed to. A friend of mine was nearly killed because he and the large truck tried to get through the intersection at the same time. I don't know who had green lights. Maybe both of them had green lights at the time.
Well, I know sometimes for us it can be tough if there's a pedestrian crosswalk because when it senses the Opticon coming, it just can't suddenly flip the opposite intersection to red if there's a pedestrian halfway through the street. It needs to let that finish its cycle in case there's an old lady walking across the street. So as much as we would love it, if the moment they sense the fire engine coming or the ambulance coming, that it would just instantly flip to a green light, the reality is the traffic engineers just basically say, no, you can't do that. There might be someone in the middle of the street.
Yeah, well, that's a default of, Tom, and that makes perfect sense. It's a default of, you know, light changers everywhere that they're not an automatic switch for the crew to just change the direction of traffic at their will. It's a system to say, I have priority over the flow of traffic at this particular instance because I have an emergency and I need to get through. Now, obviously, in the logistics of it, there's going to be our little old lady crossing the street, and guess what? She has greater priority at that moment in time. You know, and that makes perfect sense. I'm not ganging up here, but I agree with you in terms of this aspect of, you know, we live in a litigious society. We live in a society that requires things on paper, that requires rules. Tim, I have not stopped at every single light at every time, you know, completely at a dead stop. There, you know, a lot of times you come to a light, you know, you can see around you real well, you've slowed it down, there are no obstacles in your way, and you continue rolling through. I bet you will roll through at a slower speed, but you're still practicing due regard, I think, in that situation. But to have it in policy...
Absolutely.
It's not a bad thing.
I'm not suggesting that there not be due regard. I think that the operator of the emergency vehicle should be held to extremely high standards for any thing that goes wrong. You know, the person using the lights and sirens, what's that?
How do you define that due regard? How do you give them a dead stop against, you know, operations versus what occurred and to say, hey, listen, I was following these operations as per my department? I mean, instead of saying, well, I was using my judgment, which is really something that
due regard is using judgment.
But you're using due regard within a set of policy and guidelines. Do you see what I'm saying is the difference there? One is where you're pretty much acting on your own. Yes, I'm trying to act responsibly, and I'm using this concept called due regard. And the other is I'm using due regard within the definition of my organization's protocols and operation policies.
Yeah, but you know, coming to a full stop doesn't mean that when you proceed safely.
Tim, this is about
just judgment.
Tim, I think this is also about consequence. I'll bet you that during the Apollo program, when the lunar module went down to the lunar surface, there was a tremendous amount of redundancy built in. You could say, well, show me the evidence that the redundancy stopped one of the lunar modules from crashing into the lunar surface. I can't show you that evidence because it didn't crash into the lunar surface, and I'm glad it didn't crash into the lunar surface. So I think from a risk management standpoint, you have to look at what things can damage your organization. That can take many forms. It can be harming a patient. It could be damaging your reputation, damaging your equipment. It could be a lot of different things if you do an honest risk analysis. I can't think of a whole lot that would be more catastrophic for an organization than a line of duty death because someone got killed in an intersection and maybe killed a member of the public in an intersection. It's a high-risk, high-cost, high-probability event that I think everyone would like to avoid. And so it's just one of those – I still don't see how it's different than a pre-flight checklist or any other list of criteria for any other high-risk activity. That you might. We're not saying don't go through the red light. We're saying – come to a complete stop and make sure that the intersection is cleared. And I just know from the YouTube videos I watched yesterday at the officers' meeting, it doesn't always happen. It's on paper, but it doesn't always happen. In a perfect world, we would all use judgment. And if that were the case, we wouldn't need government at all. We wouldn't need the U.S. Constitution. We'd all be perfect angels, and we'd all treat each other right, and no one would starve. But the reality is men aren't angels, and firemen are not angels for sure.
A lot of that depends on the supervision. And as you said, do you think that things are more important to the fire chief than this? So they make a decision to have one mindless rule that will supersede everything else. You come to a full stop, then whether you start driving with judgment from there doesn't matter because you have that one rule and you've taught them this is the rule that matters. judgment does not matter.
Right. I'm sorry, Tom. I know where you're going with this, and I think that we're focusing in on a particular spot on this. I definitely see some logic to what Tim is saying here in terms of using judgment, and it's certainly a resource that is underutilized in a lot of the emergency response industries we do, and a lot of the emergency responses we do. And Tom, I get it from a point, I get it completely, your argument. I mean, I support it. That's sort of the direction I'm coming from. And yeah, you know, show me something didn't affect it when something didn't happen is a hard argument to form or to support. But if we step back from this and take a more global view and just say, hey, you know, does our response, lights and sirens, get us there faster? Is it a benefit to the patients? Is it a benefit to the public? I think that's more of the, you know, the angle that we need to look at this. You know, not in the minutiae, but on the macro scale, are we doing the right thing by having these vehicles speed through, having these light changers there? I mean, are we getting there any further, faster? And even more importantly, I want to throw into that question, when we turn it around and head back to the hospital and we have the equipment on board, and Tim has made this argument many times that, you know, if you're a well-trained medic and you know what you're doing, you can handle your patient, do you really need to zip back to the hospital unless there is a set of skills or something that you don't have on the bus?
Well, I know our culture on Hilton Head Island is that it's very rare for us to go to the hospital lights and sirens. So that's something I noticed from the very first day I stepped foot into this organization, because that was not the culture of the EMS system that I had come from. But I would say, unless there is a very good reason to go to the hospital lights and sirens, then we don't. We do our best to stabilize the patient, and then we transport and obey all applicable traffic regulations. But you know, as far as on the way to the scene, it's tempting to think that it's all about being allowed to exceed the speed limit. It's not. I mean, in the state of South Carolina, if you have your warning lights activated and your sirens activated, it basically means that the normal traffic rules, whatever they are, don't apply to you so long as you are following due regard. That could be driving the wrong way down a one-way street. That could be making a U-turn where you normally wouldn't be allowed to make one. So
when you flip on the lights and sirens in South Carolina, you become exempt from normal traffic regulations?
That is correct. The only thing that state of South Carolina requires is that we follow due regard. Now, we still have to be licensed. I'm not saying that that's not the case. We still have to be a licensed emergency vehicle operator and whatnot. And as any EMS attorney will tell you, you will still be held to your department standard if you have SOGs and policies and things like that. But as far as what the law says in the state of South Carolina, it is due regard.
Wow.
Which is judgment.
Wow. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, one of the things that I was reading here in our standard ops is that each EMS response vehicle, the operator must recognize that the emergency vehicle has no absolute right of way. It is qualified and cannot be taken forcefully. And I know that makes sense.
I don't think Tom said anything different.
Right. No, I didn't, because that would not be exercising due regard.
Yeah, I think the right wording is just a little different. I mean, the end result of what they want you to do is the same for that. And I think that there is a certain amount of judgment being made, especially we talking about the whole red light issue. There is judgment being made. I mean, even if you get to a red light where there's heavy traffic, you are going to you're going to be forced to come to a full stop, because the traffic is – there's no way you can even creep through that, because you'll wind up getting into an accident. But you get into a red light where the traffic isn't so heavy or there isn't that much traffic going on, but the light is red, then you're going to wind up rolling through it. You're not going to want to come into a complete stop. And I've actually, for the most part, I've had people that drive that have the sense to, you know, gauge what speed to be going through a red light. Now, I've never had an issue with somebody who's barreling through it, you know, without even looking or paying any attention to the traffic that's in the intersection. So I think most providers do have that. They try to have that judgment. But I think that most agencies have a policy of stopping, coming to a complete stop. And that's, I think, because they want to be able to, you know, turn around and bounce that back as, you know, you did or you did not follow that rule, and you did, and before you got into that accident type thing.
Well, they want to be able in court to say,
right,
we have a rule, they broke the rule, it's the fault of the individual, rather
right,
than saying, we're an organization who puts people in large vehicles on the street, and we should teach them how to drive responsibly, but we do not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what happens when you've taken those, what happens when you take those steps and you teach, like Tom was saying, and I'm EVOC, I'm SIVO trained, I'm hospital trained, I've had numerous trainings for vehicle operation, okay? I have a good driving record, and I'm pretty much a safe guy. But what happens, what do you do when something in that chain of custody breaks down and, you know, the accident happens? I mean, do you go, well, the person is well-trained, they're a good person, they think on their feet, they use their common sense, and this situation, whatever it is, went wrong? I mean,
well, if you train people to use judgment, you should expect that the number of accidents you have will decrease and the seriousness of the accidents will decrease because they're anticipating the things. I drive with people who are suddenly surprised when somebody passes them quickly. You know, there will always be somebody on the street who's driving 30 miles an hour faster than somebody else, and they practically jump out of their seat when somebody passes them like that because they're not aware of the other vehicles on the road. You need to teach people to have awareness of what's going on, to think about how other drivers react when they hear a siren, when they see the lights, and when you've got vehicles with emergency lights and sirens coming from different directions.
I mean, you're going to have accidents. You're not going to be able to avoid it. I think that the key is to have that training in place and have your personnel understand what's expected of them. I know, Tom, initially you had mentioned that the whether or not you respond lights and sirens is more of a judgment call by the crew that's you know responding to the assignment. But that's something too, I think, where if it's not something written down that you respond to this call a certain way or that call a certain way, that if something does go wrong as far as patient outcome in the end, where the patient maybe had a negative outcome because you didn't get there in 2 minutes sooner, whether or not it's really valid or not, you know, you kind of open it up to that whole liability thing of, you know, somebody calling them into court and saying, well, you didn't go lights and sirens and that's what's on the books type thing. Yeah, whether or not
one of
right.
the reasons why we need some serious legal reform.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, that's the type of thing. I think sometimes that we respond lights and sirens to calls because it's sort of like a public expectation that, you know, an ambulance is going to a call, it's going to be lights and sirens. Doesn't matter if it's a cardiac arrest or a lift assist. You know, they're expecting you to respond with your lights and sirens on, and if you don't and the negative outcome to a patient, now all of a sudden, you know, the ambulance crew is, you know, at fault, you know, for it. Whereas, you know, there's nothing that really, I guess, shows that responding that much faster to a lot of calls is going to make that much of a difference in patient outcome for your average, you know, emergency assignment you're responding to.
And I think that's the big point, Jim. I think that, you know, what we gauge, what are, it's almost in this case where guidelines almost work against us, because they have sat there and they said, okay, and I feel like I'm defending Tim here, you know, they've removed all thinking from the protocol, from the procedure, and said, this is a level one, this is a level two, this is a level three, whatever it is, and you're going to respond in this manner or fashion. And they're not going to say, well, you know, we have a 25-year-old that has abdominal pain for 2 days, you know, and do you think that they're going, you think another 3 minutes in your response time is going to change the outcome of your visit? You know, I agree with what was said previously with the, you know, cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, those sort of things. Hey, every second counts. There's no doubt about it, and it's pretty much proven. But, some of the calls that you have to respond lights and sirens to just because it's protocol is insane. I don't think it makes a difference. And I think we need reform.
The only calls that have been shown to have a difference in outcome because of the speed of response are cardiac arrests. We need to get juries to understand that so that, or get lawyers to understand that so that we're not focused on this what if stuff.
Right, you've got to have lawyers that are
a big problem.
You have to have lawyers that are on our side that are willing to go ahead and look that up and say, okay, well, there really is no, you know, concrete proof that responding to that abdominal pain lights and sirens is going to make a difference getting there a few minutes earlier in patient outcome.
Part of the problem seems to be that the plaintiff's lawyers are willing to spend a fortune on expert witnesses who may not know what they're talking about, but they're very charismatic and convince a jury, while the defense lawyers tend to be on salary rather than on commission, and they're looking at what's the cheapest way I can settle this,
right,
which
what's
not
the
way
now?
To go into a fight.
What's the settlement amount, and how can I, you know, take it out on some employee and make them be the scapegoat, you know, for it because they didn't follow, you know,
exactly.
The policy. I mean, I don't know what the answer is.
The way to get at the truth. And the legal system is supposed to provide us a way with getting at the truth. The jury is supposed to be unbiased in their approach to this. They're supposed to be people picked off the street who are not prejudiced toward either side of the case, but they have
they're
no knowledge of the material.
And they're human beings. They're going to be prejudiced regardless. I mean, everybody has their own experiences that they bring to the table.
Jury selection is supposed to minimize that. If we had some sort of expert medical juries to handle medical cases would be one way of handling this. How you come about selecting the experts for that, I don't know, but John Edwards would not be a rich man because he wouldn't be able to convince a dozen people at a time that birth defects are due to malpractice of an obstetrician.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the whole answer would be. I mean, there is merit in, you know, having people held accountable and having people be able to make judgment, you know, and at the same time, like Tom mentioned too, it's also, you know, good to have some type of a checklist that you're going down, especially when you're expected to be operating and doing things at a higher level of expertise than the general, you know, the general public is. I guess training is probably the key.
But they're not necessarily relevant to this because checklists should be limited to things that are important and relevant. And
well, operation in an emergency is relevant and important. Not that it can be, completely delineated to a checklist, but a checklist of how you operate is definitely appropriate in this case. You know, are
okay,
you
– while you're driving down the road, are you going to be looking at a checklist and saying, okay, I must come to a full stop. Let me check that off, and then you proceed.
You're being too literal here, Tim. Come on. I mean, give it cut a little slack there. You're being a little literal. I mean, when you're talking, when we're talking about checklists and this sort of thing, I think we're really referencing good training, which is what you're a proponent of, good judgment, which I know you're a proponent of, and operation and execution of that training and judgment in a responsible fashion. I don't think you argue with any of those
points. The problem
points.
Is that using judgment requires more involved oversight, more intelligent oversight than just coming up with simple lists of things that must be done, which is different from the checklist that improves safety. This is the kind of checklist that allows you to have your lowest common denominators continue in the service. That's not what anybody wants, except those lowest common denominators and the lawyers.
Yeah, I think it has to really be a combination of what we're talking about. I don't think there's any one way that you can, you know, really solve it. No matter how you look at it, there's still going to be accidents, and there's still going to be somebody looking to blame somebody for the accident. And, you know, most of the time it's probably going to be the emergency responders that are going to get blamed for not having enough due regard. For things, and then you go back to, you know, stopping completely at a red light, because what's the most due regard at a red light? The most due regard you're going to have is coming to a complete stop. You know, so you kind of kind of go in circles.
That's the slowest that you can through it, but you still have to start again. Due regard is using judgment. It is paying attention to the safety of others. And coming to a full stop does not necessarily improve the safety of others. Focusing on that discourages teaching judgment, discourages enforcing of judgment.
I don't want to get too much into it. We only have about, you know, 3 minutes or so left in the show. But, you know, I understand what you're saying as far as judgment. It is still due regard. I know what you're meaning. But at the same time, our due regard in approaching red light, you know, the general public is not expecting ambulance to be approaching the intersection. They're not looking for us to be rolling through, you know, an intersection where they have a green light. So by just rolling through it, you know, and not coming to a complete stop, you know, then you open yourself up to somebody saying the ambulance is
the general public doesn't expect us to stop. They think that we can just blast through there.
Right.
They don't think we have to stop at all.
Right, but they don't expect us to be showing up either. They don't expect us to come through it. I mean, how many times half the time they don't even hear the siren because they have their radio on, the air conditioner on, things like that. They don't even hear the siren.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of a fine line, I think. And I understand what you're saying as far as being able to use judgment approaching intersections and things like that. But at the same time, if there's a negative outcome because you didn't, you know, operate at the highest level of safety, which of course would be coming to a complete stop, then you wind up opening up that litigation. You know,
coming to a full stop, I don't believe, is the highest level of safety.
But here's the thing, Tim. It's sort of been already established. You, in your judgment and the way that you look at this, may decide that it's not the best and not the safest thing to do. But a lot of other people who have also looked at this and written the protocols around it and command people to operate in this fashion do think that's the highest level of safety.
And a lot of people told me the same thing about medical protocols that I have ended up changing. So, yeah.
All right, well,
we're
last class, so we can't get too much into the medical end
first
of it.
First of all.
We can't get too much into the medical part of it because then we'll be going on. Guys, any last thoughts, Tom? Anything you want to add before we end tonight?
Well, I guess I would just say that it may not have been directly studied in any kind of randomized way, say, but I think there is evidence that speed is a factor in most motor vehicle accidents. I think that it is a fact that most motor vehicle collisions happen in intersections. And it's also a fact that one of the highest number of line of duty deaths for firefighters are traffic accidents. So I guess my thought is that a large number of those accidents, that was people using their best judgment. And I think a lot of them were trained. So I guess from my standpoint, it's a balance. You try and teach people, and you tell them what the expectations are, and you encourage them by having a culture of defensive driving and exercising due regard. But I think you also have to put in some rules, some regulations, because frankly, every physician in the world that's ever railed against evidence-based medicine, Tim, has said it's taking away physician judgment.
Huh. All right, listen, guys, I only got about 30 seconds left.
Well said.
Go ahead.
Well said.
How do you conclude that the people who got into accidents were using their best judgment at the time they got into accidents?
I'm basing that on the fact that if you look at the HVAC system and most aviation accidents, they usually boil down to pilot error. And so I think human factors is a huge component of accidents.
Pilots are much more highly trained than automobile drivers.
Yeah, well, I understand that may be.
They're not allowed to listen to the radio. They're not allowed to do a lot of things that people do while driving that a pilot would be fired for if they did it while trying to fly a plane.
Well, I agree that the average pilot is probably 100 times smarter than the average person that drives around our streets, Tim. I guess what I'm saying is if you look at the variables that are involved in motor vehicle collisions, you know they happen at intersections, and you know they happen because people drive too fast. I'm not saying every fireman that's ever been in an accident was to blame. I'm saying from a fire chief's perspective, if you want to reduce the risk to both your firefighters and to the members of the general public, what things are in your span of control? You can try and control how fast people drive, and you can try and control how they drive through intersections. And I guess all I'm saying is I can't prove to you that it's safer that way, but I intuitively it just seems like it would have to be. If you say we want
it should be studied.
Well, sure, I'm okay with that.
I definitely think it should be studied. Guys, I want to end it here because we're a little bit overrunning. I don't want to anyone that's listening, I don't want the recording, I don't want them getting cut off. I think you guys made some great points tonight. I really thank you for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time. Again, both great points on both sides. I really appreciate it. Of course, you're welcome back anytime. Any time you want to come back on the show, I'd be glad to have you here. Have a great night, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Good night.